Nota bene, we have overcome technical deficiencies and difficulties, mostly of my own creating. What's up, Nate Freeman on the Zoomy?
Oh man, I am feeling fantastic. Ready for the weekend. Getting ready for a big meal tonight at one of my favorite restaurants, Corner Bar.
Oh, we haven't been there in a minute, I bet.
No, I haven't. It's been a long time. But yes, the Ignacio Matos Restaurant Empire will be frequented. What's on your agenda?
It's Friday. It's Shabbos. Nothing.
Great.
Amazing. As little as possible. I got to go pick up my new iPhone in a few minutes. But
oh, Mazel. That's great.
Yeah, you know, a little something for the.
Just treat yourself. Treat yourself.
Treat myself. Have you? I heard any rumblings about this new sushi joint from the Scaris Pizza guys?
We got a call from Andrew Kuo. I think him and Joe Cole went this week. I ducked my head into it just because I wanted to see it. But I did not dine.
Yeah, cool. I kind of want to check it out. It feels like it might be tragically sneakerhead pilled a little bit, but that's okay.
That's okay.
As some of the kind of high end sushi is these days, it's like very fucking NFT adjacent.
Yeah, we don't want that because now NFTs have lost 100% of their value. Thank fucking God. What losers?
I had a pretty cursed meal, other than great company, last weekend at La Roque. My spider sense should have tingled when I saw that I could have gotten a table at 7, 7:30, 8, 8:30, and on through on a Saturday night.
Oh,
I figured maybe, you know, it was a,
I think rolled the rocks.
Rolled up there and it was like the dining room was half empty. It was a big tourist crowd, which I guess it needs to be viable in that location. Nothing wrong with that. I like the out-of-towners, but it wasn't like a year ago or whenever it was it first opened and I was going, like, it felt like you knew half the people in there.
Yeah.
It was a bumping room. Didn't feel like this. Like, even though I had a resi and it was half empty, like kind of a meh table from my standpoint. It's okay. Like, I don't have an ego about it. It was also wobbly and they couldn't get it to stop wobbling. They had to move us like inelegantly. Like, I had to shine my flashlight to help the guy that was trying to get the shimmies under there. It didn't feel elegant. Didn't feel elegant at all. I actually almost got up when I remembered that they didn't have Diet Coke when I tried to order it. That feels not okay to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, these things go through cycles and
but I just want taking... I want to keep bitching for a second. It's okay, not okay not to have, in the year of our Lord 2023, it's like an affectation not to have Diet Coke, not to have a Coke gun at the bar. It's just like, it's so lame. It's so like try hard, in my opinion. Like, look at how culinarily sophisticated we are. We only have Mexican Coke in a bottle. Fuck you. Give me my caffeine without calories.
All right. Well, that is very legit. I do want to just put on your radar, Benjamin, that the French guys, the La Roque guys, are taking over what used to be Le Voudour, which is a very old school French bistro that closed in 2019. And I think that's going to be fucking sick. I think it's
I like the idea of this, like taking an old classic, much like the S&P guy, S&P Deli up here. Like, but let's see if these guys can pull it off with changing just enough to like make you want to go there, but not too much. But I think in general, the whole dining as somewhat pastiche theater, if you will, you know, this kind of nostalgic bent might be past its sell-by date.
You're not going to Carbone anytime soon?
Yeah, Carbone's over, honey. Hadn't you heard? It got killed by this big article in a major national magazine.
Right. Yeah. No. I apologize for that.
It was great for the time it existed in. It was fucking fantastic. My first three times at Carbone, like, no doubt, incredible. Mm-hmm. The grill, still snapping.
The grill's great. Fuck with the grill hard. So good.
That's like the right balance of elegance and that kind of theatricality that I'm down for. I know a friend of mine, wasn't able to go, but a friend of mine had a sort of a pre-birthday celebratory dinner there last night, and she was saying that it was off the charts good. They had a great time. Speaking of Midtown, I went, this very same person, I went 2 days in a row with two different interrelated friends groups to play a little bit of the world's greatest game of tennis. In a little-known private club in Sutton Place, have to say, highly, highly recommend.
Wow. Okay. It's tell me all the details you can.
So I'm gonna leave the club name out of it, I think. But like, let me just set the stage. You're in some place. You have to like take like you know, get, kind of the middle of nowhere. While being in the heart of Manhattan, in the middle of nowhere, if that makes any sense. One of the
Totally.
most elegant neighborhoods, though, because of that, perhaps, on these quiet streets. So you go into a just slightly post-war apartment building complex, and as the name of the club out there, the doorman greets you, says, "Oh, the tennis club right this way." You open a door, you go down this amazing hallway filled with tennis rackets, with a brass nameplate for every member there. Lots of names you would know, Nate. Lots of names the public would know. I'm not going to blow any of them up. And just incredible. And you emerge into this like kind of like, you know, there's beautiful locker rooms and there's like a dining club clubhouse with a pro shop and then three beautiful Hartrue clay tennis courts surrounded by the apartment buildings of Sutton Place. Really special. Felt like a secret within the heart of the city. That's a great fucking thing about New York. It's just full of secrets no matter how much time you spend here looking.
Exactly. Oh, that sounds fucking great. Wow. Well, that is a highlight of your week and anyone's week, you know. I
I'm
don't
still
really
hyped on it. I'm not going to blow up the names of people invited me, but they know that I love them and I thank them very much. It was a special opportunity. Two different people, same week.
We went to an opening at the Frick Madison together.
That's right, we did. That was awesome.
It was
That
awesome.
was
Barclay
awesome.
Hendrix, really cool show. I mean, you know, it's still kind of magical to see shows in that building. I hope that continues to be the case once Sotheby's takes it over imminently. But yeah, great crowd, great show, you know, really cool.
Super cool show. I mean, great show. It could have been bigger for me, but it was great to
Sure.
see. But still, it was very large considering how little of his work has been seen brought together. I think you and I were both struck by how many of the works on view in the show. I think there were probably 16 pictures in the show, maybe something like that. How many of them came from University Museum collections?
Shout out the Nashville Museum at the wonderful Duke University, which obviously I went to. There's a
Yeah, and there was.
great, great work that Nashville owns.
Yeah,
Maybe
no, it
the
was a
best work.
fantastic picture.
So that was fun. We had a nice dinner after that with a friend of the pod. I'm not sure if he wants to be mentioned on here.
No, but we love him. We went to an inc I think we can talk about the restaurant without blowing it up, or do you think that's dangerous?
I think it's a little dangerous, unfortunately, because this place is too good. We can't lose it,
Okay.
man. We can't say
Much
it.
like the unnamed tennis club, this restaurant was a classic New York. By the way, both the people that I was playing tennis, I mentioned where we went to have supper, and like, oh yeah, of course. My
Okay.
father had like a table, like a standing table
Of
there.
course. Your listeners can't get this one. Sorry.
Yeah, it was so good. I think the chicken limon, which is not a dish I would ever order off any
Un
menu.
unreal. So good. So
I said,
fantastic.
you and I did the smart thing when we said to our host, who had been to this restaurant innumerable times and who wanted to share it with us, we're going to put down our menus. You order for the table. And he crushed it. Absolutely delicious. A pasta dish that was like, if I were to describe it wouldn't even make sense that it was good, but it was great.
It wild pasta dish. I don't think anything I've ever had. It's shells with like a gravy and cheese. So fantastic. So good.
Yeah, it was good stuff. So that's what's going on in the like a little bit of art there and culture and food. What else has been happening in the art world? We get into it with our guest, who's the amazing Jeremy Hodkin from The Canvas, and I think I'm saying that
Stay
correctly. He's
tuned
coming up
for
right after
that.
this, and we get into some of the stories of the day. Did we miss anything in our chat with him that we should chat about for the listeners?
I mean, there's a lot going on, like in the next few weeks, especially once we get into the fairs. There's some things in New York the week before that. Not too much this week, which was nice. It was nice to have a little break. I did make it to the David Zwirner Gallery last night, opening of the show by Emma McIntyre, her first show with the gallery. She shows with the wonderful Chateau Gallery in Los Angeles, helmed by our friend of the pod, Liv Barrett.
Yeah, those pictures were in very high demand at this Zwirner Gallery. They told me that they could have sold each one 20 times over. I think they were nice. They were perfectly nice pictures. I only saw the
Really
PDF. I
nice.
didn't make it to the opening. But they're beautiful, very well priced. Probably one of the lower priced invoices you could ever get under the David Zwirner letterhead.
Packed opening, but I had to get home for dinner here. David Zwirner actually asked me if I was going to stick around. I said, no, I have to go home. We're
And
having
walk the dog.
cheeseburgers. Well, that I had to do later. But I told him we were having cheeseburgers. He says, lady eats cheeseburgers? And I said, small cheeseburgers. small little cheeseburger, David.
Little baby cheeseburger for the lady.
And he approves. Just glad. Yeah, we have to run all of our meals by David Zwirner before we feed ladies. So
I like that. He is the godfather after all. Yeah. You know? we're not going to get into it now, but speaking of David, there was a really interesting interview with him with our friend Charlotte Burns in the Art newspaper this past couple days. And we're going to get into some of the details of that with Jeremy in just a second, right?
Yeah. We will get all into that. I mean, we kind of go through the whole week stuff with Jeremy. I'm just thinking, do you have anything else on your horizon? I'm going to a wedding tomorrow, a big Our World wedding. I'm not going to say who's.
What's us with not naming anything? No one's going to, people are going to stop listening, man. We're such pussies. Sorry, pussies. I shouldn't use that word in a derisive way. We're such wimps.
You know what? Maybe I'll reveal whose wedding it is when I do a recap of the wedding. Maybe I'll ask the groom when I'm there if it's okay. I think that would be more fun anyway.
Okay. Yeah. I get nothing on the horizon. I have to go to the West Coast next week and do some studio visits, some galleries, install some art, come back for a few days, and then head over to London Town. And we'll get into that more next week. But I think, you know, we get into this also in the second half of the pod, and we have a very long interview with Jeremy coming up. But, you know, everyone is sort of waiting with bated breath to see where the art market is right now. It's real hard to make any moves or feel really confident. There's a ton of uncertainty around. So I think that's really kind of what we're up against. I think some of that will play out in London and Paris, of course. And then I think really what happens in November at the auctions are going to really set the tone for the next 18 months. So fingers crossed, time will tell.
Fingers crossed, time will tell. All right, I'm late to get a tuxedo.
I get to get my phone and edit this damn thing. So sorry for the quick intro, but it's well worth sticking around for this great interview with Jeremy coming up right.
After this.
Welcome back to Nota Bene. Nate and I are so pleased to be joined by the journalist and newsletter writer and man that kind of knows where a lot of the bodies are buried, Jeremy Hudkin.
Jeremy,
how you doing, buddy?
Welcome to the
pod. My pleasure to be here, guys. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Took too long to have you on. This has been in the works for a while.
It's I'm here now. That's what's
important.
What matters. And although I wouldn't necessarily describe myself as a journalist, but everything else.
That's a great place to start off, and I'm glad I didn't need to throw any chairs today. How would you describe yourself? What do you do? Who are you?
Well, I write The Canvas. It's an art market newsletter. It goes deep inside kind of like the halls of power of the art world. But I don't know, journalist feels like it has all kinds of rules attached. And I don't know.
So many rules.
Try to skate the edge of those rules.
Just this side of the libel laws.
Exactly.
And what is your background? Like, how did you come to decide to focus on this particular venture and the art world and the market in particular?
I never really expected to end up in the art world. I had a startup in college, and through that startup, I knew Judd Tully, who was the editor at large at Art and Auction magazine at the time. And Judd. He told me that his company, Luis Bluen Media, was looking to hire a head of video. And I obviously did a lot of research on the company and knew what I was going into, and was able to stomach it for about 2 years before I just couldn't take the craziness anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was my first kind of entree into the art world. After that, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. I did some marketing, like freelance for a couple galleries, a couple auction houses. And then I started The Canvas, May 2017.
Amazing. And, you know, for those who don't know, The Canvas is a regular newsletter that goes out that focuses on personalities, on people in the art world, on people that are movers and shakers, both collectors, dealers, auction house employees, and on specific market moments and stories. Is that a fair description without looking at the website?
Yeah. I think that was a great description, Ben. I wish I took
you that. You can use that in the deck
to make it easier on myself.
No problem.
Yeah. When I first started The Canvas, the original idea was to only publish during the major weeks of the year for the art world. So the the fairs, the auction weeks in London and New York. I never liked the business model of a 24/7 website, and I don't think the art world really needs a 24/7 news website. There's just not enough actually going on to justify it. But then you'll have a week like Art Basel Miami Beach when there's so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll publish daily.
And sorry, I just distracted myself. So that was the impetus. And how did you become, I mean, one thing about the canvas for those who aren't privileged enough to be subscribers, and I encourage you to do as such, is you research and report fairly well sourced for major individual stories, oftentimes in a wonderful way on background, but you get people to tell you things that that other people don't know. And that's really hard in this world where people are keep the information very close to their chest as that information is actionable and has economic repercussions. So how did you build the relationships and the trust with those relationships and able to be able to do what you do?
Well, first of all, thank you very kindly for those words of flattery. I appreciate it. Look, I think it all comes down to trust. And I think the people who I'm talking to know that I'm not going to go back on my word. I'm not going to, you know, publish something that they're going to regret in any way. And, you know, once a person of a type of stature sees their colleagues quoted in the canvas, I think that kind of acts as an impetus to participate themselves. But, you know, whether I say it's the conversations off the record or on background or, you know, quotable, it's just a matter of respecting those guidelines and never betraying the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And was there a moment, go ahead, Nate.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I can very happily acknowledge that you have broken some pretty big news over the years, gotten some big interviews. You know, scoop me a few times, you know, which, you know.
That's my main motivation, Nate.
Well, you know, it's you know, good for the art world. You know, can you think back on just some of the biggest sort of stories that you broke in the canvas, like off the top of your head? Just like some big moments? Like
the biggest, the first big break was the buyer of the Monet at Sotheby's for $110 million. It was a really weird situation where you were there that night, right,
yeah.
Nate? Mm-hmm. So if you remember, it was a pair of bidders seated in the way back of Sotheby's sales room, and nobody really had any idea who they were. Everyone else was bidding on the phone. But somebody tipped me off that these two were bidding on behalf of Hasso Plattner, the German software billionaire. And I was able to get another confirmation of that. And then I kind of poked around to get some contextualizing information. And he denied it when I published it. But then it turned out to be 100% accurate when the painting showed up in his museum a couple years later. So look, I the art world is obviously known for its discretion and people keeping a tight lid on things. You know, some of these guys get away with it by saying that their foundation bought it and not themselves. You know, they'll say anything their PR person will say anything to throw you off the story. That was a big one that comes to mind. And probably it was during Art Basel Miami, and it was all this chatter beginning to bubble up about Art Basel Hong Kong, 2020, I guess. So the first one that was going to get canceled, and dealers kind of talking about whether they'll get their refunds back, or whether they'll get their deposits refunded back, and kind of the inside process and dialogue going on there. Those are two that come to mind off the top of my head.
And that was being canceled because of the protests. That was before COVID really broke, right?
So the protests were the main concern. But for those who have a weird fascination with pandemics, like myself, and I get that from my sister probably, the virus started making international news, albeit, you know, in a small way in early December
of
that year. So it did start to, it was already starting to bubble up.
So the reason we wanted to have you on this week, specifically, was we want to hear about the history of the canvas. I'm sure we'll get into some different gossip we've all been hearing in anticipation of this really kind of important and somewhat frightening art season, given the state of the economy. We published what I thought was a great and really insightful story about some breaking news that wasn't immediately, for me at least, something that was art world focused, but you managed to kind of think a little bit more broadly and give a really 30,000 foot view into what the acquisition, by the Pinot family of CAA might mean for the larger ambitions of that family and their luxury goods group, and about the larger luxury goods and art economy and as it relates to entertainment. So if you want to take us through the basics of that story that you reported, I thought was so insightful.
François-Henri Pinault, who is currently the head of his family's, holding company, Artemis, through which they own a majority stake in Kering, the luxury conglomerate, which owns, you'll have to help me out here. It owns
Saint Laurent, Gucci,
Saint Laurent, Bottega,
Balenciaga.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So a bunch of them. Not LVMH, but, you know, kind of the second largest luxury conglomerate. And Christie's. And they obviously, through the father of François-Henri, own a very important, amazing, starry collection of art. Easily one of the biggest art collectors in the world. So François-Henri Pinault decided to invest and buy a majority stake in the Hollywood talent agency, Creative Artists Agency, CAA, which, other than Endeavor, which is run by Ari Emanuel and co, is pretty much one of the biggest talent agencies there are. Mm. And he's buying the stake through from the private equity firm TPG, which bought their stake back in 2010, I believe. So he'll now own 53% of the company, I believe. It's been in the works for months. There was a lot of chatter about it over the summer at the Allen & Co. Sun Valley.
Yeah.
There we go. Conference where he showed up, and he doesn't normally attend each year. It's really interesting. It's just kind of the latest example of these blurred lines between the art world, the fashion world, entertainment, luxury. It's all, for better or worse, coming together.
Of course, Ari Emanuel, Nate's good friend, Ari Emanuel's Endeavor.
Shout out, Ari.
It's the Frieze art fairs and have entree there. And so it's interesting to see Pinault move and kind of really change everything else that they've invested in over time. It's quite a sea change, and it's a large scale investment for the holding company in terms of like their portfolio at large. And it's an interesting time to be getting into entertainment, you know, in the midst of a Hollywood strike. But I think he sees the possibility of a confluence between luxury brands, which I would include Christie's as, but a separate silo of it, and CAA. And I think, you know, different than we think of as, at least I have always thought of entertainment talent agents in the past, they don't just represent artists and directors and composers and musicians and whatnot. They really help package together deals now, especially in this age of streaming. They're really instrumental in pulling together all the different talent, representing sports leagues and their negotiations with television broadcasters. I mean, it's really as much business development and business strategy as it is simply trying to attach a particular star to a picture, like it was in the good old days of the go-go 80s, I think. So I think, I wonder if there's something about that Pinault and the change in the entertainment industry that he sees as particularly interesting right now.
Yeah, so a couple of things. First, the conversations regarding investing in CAA predated the strikes. So I think he knew that they were a possibility going in. CAA does have the largest sports talent agency in the world. And yes, packaging has historically been one of CAA's main strengths, although a couple of years ago, when the last contract for the Writers Guild was being negotiated, they argued to roll back some of the packaging that these agencies were doing, as it was negatively impacting the writers' fees, I'm not a Hollywood journalist, so I don't know.
No, that sounds right.
Who's more proficient in that area. So yes, packaging is still a main part of CAA's business. It's just not as centered as such these days. But, you know, I think Pinot obviously sees a lot of room for collaboration between Kering and CAA. Although the fashion people will tell you that, you know, it's in no one's best interest for Kering or for CAA clients to have an exclusive arrangement with Kering brands. It kind of needs, just like the art world needs both Christie's and Sotheby's to operate, you know, efficiently for everyone. The fashion world needs people both easily working with LVMH and Kering. But yeah, I think he does see a lot of room for collaboration. It was an unusual move for the family. His father kind of slowly built Kering brand by brand over many years. And they've never really invested in anything, certainly not as high profile, not as large of a stake. So yeah, it's a kind of a sea change for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there something to be said about Francois Henri kind of now putting his own mark on the Artemis, you know, brand through this acquisition?
So yeah, so I mean, eagle-eyed readers of the piece that you know I published a couple weeks ago about this may have zeroed in on a line somewhere where I talked about the difference in between how the son and the father view Christie's. Christie's, I think Francois bought Christie's in 98.
Yeah,
somewhere
in the
around 90s. There.
Yeah.
And for him, it was really like a passion project, you know. It didn't cost a ton of money, certainly not anywhere compared to what it would go for these days. And he's been a serious collector who like really loves the art world and the intricacies of artists and their histories and really kind of learning about it. And for him, Christie's was always kind of a passion play. The son reportedly is not as much of an art world person, certainly not compared to his father. And also just in general, doesn't seem to have as much interest in the art world. And because of that, there have been concerns in some offices at 20 Rockefeller and King James Street or St. James Street or whatever in London, that as the father, you know, continues to age, the son might look to divest from Christie's because it's not a core part of his vision or what he's interested in. Others will say, or kind of the alternative or the flip side to that argument is that, no, he is fully committed to Christie's because he views it like his other companies and brands as a luxury brand. And he sees the value in it as a luxury brand, and that's why he's sticking with Christie's for the long term. I don't know. Who can divine the ways of billionaires?
I mean, that brings in three main points. But first, I think we should mention real quickly, for those who don't know, I mean, the Pinot collection is incredible, and it shows the father, Pater Fermaris Pinot, is like a true denizen of the art world, with spaces spread across Venice and Paris. They don't just show, it isn't just... it isn't
trophy
just
art.
Trophy hunting. It's like a real deep collection of like sometimes incredibly weird and challenging art that shows someone that has a true vision and hires people with great vision. So that's first of all. Second of all, you know, I'm interested, you know, one of the legs up that Christie's has had, I would say historically in some negotiations, is when a house guarantee needs to be on the table. Pinot is sometimes willing to say, I would own this at that price, so yes, I'm willing to open a line of credit for this. And that can add a little extra value sometimes in negotiations or in competition between the two houses. But the third thing that it brings up is, I wonder how profitable, if at all, Christie's is. As someone who's worked at a lesser auction house, I can say the margins are incredibly, incredibly thin. Because of the competition between the two largest and Phillips as well, to a degree, they really cut themselves very, very skinny, and they're very expensive to run, which I think our friend Patrick Drahi is now realizing. So I wonder when the younger Pinot looks at the balance sheet of these properties, despite its it's a luxury goods and how that fits into the brand story of Artemis. I wonder if at the end of the day it might be something that could be sacrificed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. The profit margins at the auction houses are still a pretty big mystery to everyone. What I would say is that I have a hard time believing that either the Pinots or Drahi would stick with the business if it's not at least breaking even in some way. So they may not be profitable every single year, but I'm sure in the end, Christie's is still a net positive.
Well, let's make a quick little segue then. When we talk about Patrick as someone who wouldn't be in a business if it isn't profitable, there's been a lot of chatter in the business sections of the newspapers about his larger empire. He's someone that historically has acquired new targets entirely with debt, and obviously in a macro environment where the cost of cash is very, very expensive, and he has some fairly large payments coming due across his empire of acquisitions that may need to be restructured if they can be. So there's been a lot of chatter on the street. I'm not sure if it's by people that know necessarily, but certainly people that think they know, that Sotheby's may be for sale quietly as we speak now, or will be soon. Have you heard anything about this?
Look, what I hear is, again, two sides. Everyone's got their own spin. Drahi, according to people in Drahi world and Sotheby's, is in this for the long term. It's a generational investment. That's why he made his son, whose name I'm forgetting, the head of Asia or whatever he is.
That's a good point.
But there's no doubt that, you know, when there is smoke, there is fire. And there has been so much chatter about him taking Sotheby's back to the public market.
Right.
That I have a feeling that he's going to at least float a part of the company to do that. To your point, Ben, he's got about $50 billion in debt, or $55 billion in debt through coming due
through
2030. And most of those payments start in 2025, I believe. Bloomberg has a great breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's a leverage master. Like, I mean, every deal he does is, you know, leveraged and well thought out. He usually takes the real estate assets from whatever company he's playing with and turns it into a separate company, then gets a mortgage against that, which I believe is what he did with Sotheby's.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, I spent one unfortunate night trying to pour through the Sotheby's UK filings, the company mm-hmm. house filings. It's a labyrinth of
right. I'm sure.
Who the hell knows? Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thing I miss is when Sotheby's was a publicly traded company, was that it was one of the few vantage points into the high-end art market that we all got every year, was to go through those SEC required filings, so mm-hmm. we could kind of begin to
quarterly.
See what was behind the curtain a little bit.
They had the quarterly calls. So entertaining.
Yeah.
Miss you, Tad.
Wonder what Tad's doing right now.
I think he's much like a former House Speaker John Roberts, sitting with a glass of root glass Merlot and Marlboro Light.
That sounds pretty great.
What else have been the big stories? Did you get any blowback on the story, by the way?
I actually, it's funny.
Any good feedback or?
Yes. Well, I thought. Look, in general, I think everything I write is either complete trash or utterly brilliant. This one I thought was a pretty good piece. I got a call this morning from someone fairly high up at Sotheby's saying that they were surprised. They thought that the piece read like it was written by Christie's PR department.
Oh, come on.
And I was surprised by that because I didn't think there are certain pieces that, you know, anyone writes and sometimes they'll be a little bit more bubbly and favorable. I didn't think this one was one of those. I thought it was a highly speculative piece. It was kind of brainstorming how Pinot could be looking at this investment and how it might affect Christie's. But I think there was some feedback that maybe Sotheby's wasn't given. I didn't give Sotheby's enough credit for pursuing the same strategy that I was arguing Pinot and Christie's might be looking towards in the future. Otherwise, you know, pretty good feedback. The only negative feedback I get is from angry, you know, billionaires. And those are scary.
Such is the danger of the job, my friend. Such is the danger. I mean, I like the piece, and I think one of the reasons we decided to finally reach out to you to come on was because it was speculative. It wasn't, you know, it was, you know, you're great because you get all these great hard news things, but I liked your step back and thinking about it in the context of all the information you do have about what this might mean, all the story behind the story.
Well, I appreciate that. Look, I'm not a fast enough writer and not trained as a journalist to be able to kind of compete on the speed side of things with people like Nate and other talented colleagues and individuals in the art world. But, you know, when I have a chance to kind of take a beat and step back and really assess and offer my own weird mix of commentary and analysis and snark mixed with news, that's always the most fun.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to just sort of continue to speculate on is just CAA, and it's now a new adjacency to Christie's. Do you think that it'll get more directly into the art world? Or there, you know, it's like UTA has its own art space, as we know.
Which I still don't know what that is.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean,
Brian Lord, who's now running CAA, is a huge collector. He was on the LACMA board for a while. I mean, obviously very speculative, but like, do you think that there will be any sort of collaboration or synergy between these two Artemis assets?
I do. I think that François-Henri is looking for more collaboration with the family's investments in general than his father usually had things. They were kind of siloed. So for instance, you now start to see occasionally like a Kering brand sponsor a Christie's sale.
Right.
So yeah, I think that CAA and Christie's will play together. I don't know if it'll be any kind of a formal relationship in any way. For instance, I speculated in the piece that I could see, you know, major CAA clients agreeing to eventually sell their memorabilia collections or whatever with Christie's. You know, I don't foresee that as being a hard and fast rule or something, you know, put into place in any kind of structured way, but I think it's probably a conversation that's just easier to have. Do I think that CAA will launch a UTA type art something business? No.
Yeah.
But only because I still don't understand that model to begin with. So
Something the world is definitely not asking for.
Right.
Yeah, that's probably true. We don't need CAA art space. No one wants that. But we could want some CAA wrapped movie stars at the sales in November. That'd be fun.
100%. I think that's a possibility. I think that there's room to experiment and play with CAA's clients and the kind of fandoms they have. Like we just saw with the Freddie Mercury sale at Sotheby's. Yep. It was really, I mean, the numbers may not have been significant compared to a contemporary evening sale, but they signed up a ton of new collectors or new prospective clients through the sale. They got a ton of people through the doors, and there were certain pieces that sold for insane prices compared to their estimates. I remember like a silver bangle that Freddie Mercury wore in one of the music videos was supposed to sell for like $8,000, went for something insane, like $980,000. I think, you know, that's a really interesting kind of case study. Like, again, I don't know what kind of memorabilia collections or art collections or anything some of these stars have, but it's not hard to envision like a Steven Spielberg sale or, you know, anyone who commands like a really passionate audience.
Moving on from this particular story, you know, we're sitting here on the precipice of two relatively major art fairs in Europe, Frieze and Frieze Masters, and then Paris Plus, the Art Basel Fair in Paris, which will fall pretty quickly by the November auctions. And it seems as though at least everyone I talk to in the upper echelons of the art market, and even in the lower echelons, is very much holding their breath. Have you heard any chatter about big non-published consignments, or, you know, what's the competition like? Are people, you know, it's a really tough time to get people to sell. And it feels like people are kind of deciding what they're going to do in terms of buying and their engagement in the art world based upon how these events turn out. Is that in line with what you've been hearing, or different, or what's the chatter on the street from your end?
I think everyone, I know that I'm certainly holding my breath for London and Paris. You know, technically the art season started up again with the Armory Show and Free Soul, but for various reasons, I think that, you know, doesn't really count necessarily as the full entree back for everyone. You know, I'm hearing similar things to you. In terms of consignments that haven't been announced yet, you mean for the auctions or privately? Yeah, mm-hmm. So no, honestly. All the news has been about Emily Fisher Landau, about who else? The Hong Kong-based collectors.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm trying to think any other major ones. Not that really come to mind. But I think that's representative of the difficulty that the auction houses are having convincing consigners to sell. I was having lunch with one executive from Christie's, and he said, look, the problem with our business is nobody needs to sell, which,
yeah,
you know, we all know. So if you're at all concerned about the market, why take the risk? So it'll take a couple of data points or a couple of seasons to really show, you know, what are realistic estimates and are the prices easily exceeding them, for people to feel comfortable coming back in the way that we saw the last couple of years. Hopefully everyone learned their lessons from May and the estimates can be reined back into a more normal territory.
Yeah. When the cost of money is what it is, and when the yield curve is inverted, maybe conservative estimates should be the order of the day.
Yeah. Although I just got an email from Masterworks touting all of their exits and whatnot. Yeah. Don't get me started on Masterworks.
Oh yeah.
I think there are a number of people that are or should be doing some deep reporting into that particular story. I don't know, man. It seems like something doesn't add up. Any investment firm that is spending the amount that they are on acquisition of new investment capital frightens me. And I'm no expert in this rain, but I don't know. I have nothing to add. Maybe you guys don't either. But
I poured through their SEC filings because what they essentially do is create a new company each time they buy a painting and then fractionalize that company. The only thing I really have to say about Masterworks is I think it's a really, really great business for the people who own the business.
Touche. Okay. Well said. I still have yet to be to their to visit their physical gallery, which I get lots of emails about them opening up. So
Lever and Co. Yeah, I know Evan Beard is running it. I also haven't had a chance to look through.
I like Evan, so we will see. Well, I think that is it for us. Nate, did you have any follow-up questions that I might have missed?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just in general, like, is there anything on your horizon that you're looking forward to covering? Any gossip that you've been hearing? Just, you know, anything you want to just discuss here while you got me and Benjamin?
Sure. I'm happy to shoot the shit. Two main stories.
What are these two stories?
So I'm still kind of closely watching the whole LVMH art world. Are no blurring of lines. You know, the daughter is on the advisory board for Gagosian. There was lots of rumors and speculation about the Warhol Monroe and the Larry and Arnaud collaborations on that. Some people thought it would show up in Tiffany's when they opened. I think when I wrote that, I think I made sure not to say explicitly that it would show up in the physical store for the opening, but I still believe that it'll show up in advertisements down the line. But I don't know. Nate, I know you've also been pretty closely following that particular angle. So I'm curious.
Yeah, well, I just saw Alex Arnaud in the sales room. and like mm-hmm. like sitting with the Mugravit. So like that's why I was like, okay, there could be something going on here. And then obviously there are rumors about some kind of LVMH Gagosian collaboration. Larry ends up buying the painting. So I think, you know, there are all kinds of lines of speculation that you can pull there.
Yeah, I mean, in May I wrote and broke the story that, you know, or was it May or God, I don't even know what is what anymore. There were a lot of rumors that LVMH was going to buy Gagosian, and that didn't sound right to me. So the actual story turned out to be that LVMH was extending a $1 billion line of credit to Larry. Whether the Monroe was the first part of that, unclear. But I think Arnaud sees a lot of value to artists in his main fashion business. And I think, look, I'm not a fashion analyst or expert, as anybody who looks at me can easily attest to. But I think, you know, the designers for a lot of these houses and brands seems to change fairly frequently these days. And I think being able to have an artist's input into a collection is something that he's thinking a lot about, Arnaud, and also then how to extend it down range into different products. So like the Capuchin handbags that Louis Vuitton has done that have artist editions have been very, very successful.
Yeah. And Kim Jones at Dior always taps an artist to collaborate with, you know.
Exactly.
You know, there are countless examples, but yeah. I know that Arnaud is very conscious of that. I think it was a very conscious choice to use that Basquiat with Jay-Z and Beyonce in the first Tiffany ads.
Although there was some blowback from that.
a little bit, but it got a lot of attention. And
It unfairly got a lot of attention, I thought, or not worthy of as much attention and screaming as
it got. They're so good at what they do. They were able to instrumentalize that and leverage that as for some great fashion PR.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Any blowback that happened localized, like happened within the art press, not in the wider yes. press that story was meant to kind of hit.
Mm-hmm. That is very, very true. So that's kind of like the one big storyline I'm continuing to watch, how fashion and the art world, obviously it's an old story, but I think we're going to see it cement and formalize more. And then the other thing I'm keeping an eye on is, unsurprisingly, Hauser. What's going on with Hauser? When will the Art Farm sister business maybe land in the U.S. In more of a...
It's coming. I mean, they're opening Manuela on Worcester Street. I walked by the other day.
Yes. And they're turning, you know, they've now turned it into kind of, I don't want to say a campus like the LA location or the Somerset location, but I think, you know, I have a feeling that down the line, something like Somerset or Menorca or LA will probably land in the US in a structured kind of way. So I'm always paying attention to Hauser because they're fun.
Yeah,
they're great at hospitality.
Yes, they are
the best in the business. I've been privileged to be their guest at certain events, and they do it better than anyone else. I wonder, and maybe this is the old school snob in me. I wonder A, about that stuff overshadowing the work of the artists that are featured in those spaces and that go there and do residencies at times. And B, I wonder more critically about, I would love to peek in those books. Like, are those money making?
Oh, yeah.
Like, do are those cash flow positives, those, you know, the Somerset and things like that, or they are drag, or what is there? That business in particular is an enigma to me, the House of mm-hmm. Business model.
Yeah. I mean, the gallery and the Art Farm business share a CEO, and the CEO came from Fortnum and Mason, I think. Ventures. I'm sure certain aspects of it are profitable, like the London restaurant that was a massive hit. Yeah, I'm sure that's doing well. I don't know if the Fife Arms, the hotel in it, you know, down the street from the Braemar or whatever, the castle. I know. I really want to go. They were nice enough to invite my girlfriend at the time, my ex, and I to Somerset for a weekend. And they put us in the guest house. And they, again, to Ben's point, it was great hospitality. She and I had lunch with Ivan and Manuela, and they were very gracious hosts. But yeah, who, you know, it's an interesting... I think the Hauser & Wirth business is a lot more structured and professional and corporate than a lot of people realize. But I also, to be fair, I don't... I know a lot of people give Hauser shit for all of the restaurant stuff and the hospitality. I think it really does come from a genuine place. Like, if you go to Somerset and kind of exist there for a bit, it's a really unique, special, and, like, thoughtful thing that they've created. And Manuela really cares about it. She cares about education deeply. She cares about food deeply, and, like, healthy food. And I think Ivan, you know, likes that as well, but he also sees a business opportunity in the long run. So just like Arnaud might look at artists as the top of the pyramid in a LVMH kind of visualization, use them as the inspiration and then funnel down into products, I think Hauser kind of looks as the products in reverse. So we've already got the artists, now let's try to figure out how to get a ceramics gallery, their make is what it's called, into every mall in America or whatever, or, you know, to start more hotels. But yeah.
I mean, they're brilliant. And I will say something about hospitality. Hospitality can't be faked. Like, really good hospitality, it can't be done just a money-making thing, in my opinion. I think it has to come from a spot of love. I think Manuela really does love those things. I think everything you just said is pretty correct about how they see it as a potential business model. Real quick, before we lose Nate's headphones and might have to wrap it up, I do want to get into, just because you're thinking about gallery models, there was an interesting interview with David Zwirner in the Art newspaper that came out this week, where he was pretty... Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, he was pretty transparent, I would say, about some things in a way that we're not used to major gallery owners being so transparent. So I'm wondering what you guys thought of that.
Nate, you go first.
You go first. I don't have it
in front of me, unfortunately. It just occurred to me.
I thought it was, you know, a great piece of reporting by Charlotte Burns. Great,
I think,
story.
Charlotte has a good relationship with David.
Yeah. I think David just, you know, isn't afraid of being intelligent and, like, being honest about this aspect of his business. And I think that reflects well upon him. I think the article made it clear that they haven't really had the best last few months in terms of PR. You know, they've lost artists. They, you know, they sunk a bunch of money into this real estate deal that wasn't really their fault, but they lost a lot of money on it. And I think that he was, like, just changing the conversation just by being honest and just, like, coming out and just discussing losing Carol Beauvais and discussing losing the Donald Trump estate and discussing losing Harold Ancart in an honest way. Realizing that, you know, Larry would never do such a thing. He would never give an interview like that. And if he did, you know, do what he did with Patrick and kind of be, you know, not very transparent about anything with Patrick Radke. And so I thought it was a great article in that way. It was a little shocking to hear a mega gallery owner just admit to sort of, like, taking the L. But in the end, I think he looks smart doing it.
I agree. I think, you know, he's definitely more open than Larry ever would be. Larry, I don't think, really cares what people are saying or what the narrative may... what narrative may be beginning to form in the press. In this case, look, I think Charlotte has a great relationship with David, so he felt comfortable and safe to talk. I think that, you know, the UK-based businesses have to report, so they're kind of boxed in that way. And I think, again, this is just speculation, I think he was like, you know, there could be a narrative being formed based off of the last couple of months and the stumbles that the gallery has taken. Either, you know, be they the fault of the gallery or just circumstantial. And he wanted to kind of address it head on and not let it fester, which I think, again, yeah, smart. Look, David Dorner is smart enough to be able to, all of the dealers at that level, all four mega dealers, theoretically, should be smart enough to be able to handle a genuine conversation with a reporter
about totally. Business. I agree.
I thought it was great. I mean, I'm a big fan of his anyway, so it just it reinforced my good feelings. All right, I think that covers a whole raft of things that I wanted to get into. I just made that word up. That's cool. I want to thank you so much, Jeremy, for coming.
Jeremy, thank you so much.
This spring, and this was fun. Yeah, I can't wait to read the new, the next issue of the Canvas.
Hopefully on Sunday before Yom Kippur.
Okay.
Great. Great to know. Let's get this up before that.
Talk to you guys later. Go to bed.
Bye, Jeremy.
Have a nice
out. Day.